Have you heard one of those yet this spring, Chelsea?
I have not heard one of those yet this spring. I did hear the Phoebe sound, though, yesterday, and I thought right away,
oh, really?
Yeah, I did. So that was exciting.
You're talking about the Phoebe of the chickadee?
Yes, that's correct.
Perfect. Also known as the cheeseburger, depending.
You know, that actually, I'm not going to be able to unhear that. I think I will hear cheeseburger from this moment forward.
You're welcome. It'll make you think of McDonald's all spring.
But no, I haven't heard the owl yet. I haven't. Have you? Yeah,
so that's the call of the Sawhat owl. The little beep, 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 beep. It sounds like they're a truck backing up. A tiny, tiny little truck. I have not heard it yet, but I have trusted people that I know have heard it in my area. I live down near Stillwater, so they're headed our way. John says that he hasn't heard one yet, but they're moving. This is the Season Watch Podcast. I'm Charlie Mitchell. That's Chelsea Perkins, our news director, captain of reporters, general cool person.
Well, I will take that title all day.
Mm-hmm. What's your official title?
News director? Yep. You got that part
right.
But
I got it.
Captain of reportins. Oh my gosh. Captain of reporters and general cool person should be on my business card as well, I think. I'll lobby for that.
We can work on that.
Well, I actually...
Nature nerd should be on mine.
Oh, totally. It should be on yours, Charlie. There's no doubt about that. I was just going to say, I go for walks a lot along the river, so I have been noticing birds coming in. They're on their way back.
Yeah. Which ones have you seen?
Well, I've seen some swans. I've seen some geese, mostly hearing them. They are very loud when they are coming in to land on the river, and they like everyone to know that their arrival is impending.
Yes, both the geese and the swans, which, birders are going to come for me for this one. But I feel like swans are kind of geese with a better outfit. They're like also pretty cantankerous and loud. And I assume they poop just as much, but I don't think they hang out on land as much. I don't know.
I think that's true. I haven't seen swans congregating in little dog piles or goose piles, if you will, along the edge of the water bodies like I do Canadian geese.
That's true. And like in my old neighborhood, I would watch the Canada geese like strut down the road with their little plap, 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 plap feet. And anytime one of my neighbors would also be walking down the road, there would kind of be this odd standoff between human and like goose. And depending on the timidness of the human, the goose would sometimes win. And that was a enjoyable part of this part of spring for me, was watching all of the bully geese on the roads being mean to people.
I have this sort of built-in fear of large birds. I mean, not so much anymore now that I've had chickens myself and things like that. But my mom always used to tell me this story about when she was a kid and she was babysitting for someone that had a turkey, a tom turkey, that every time that she went outside, it would chase her at this, you know, ridiculous speed.
Oh, no.
So I'm like, kind of grew up like feeling like, ooh, I don't know. I don't want to go within a certain radius of any large beaked creature.
Large beaked creature? Yeah, turkeys can run fast, like 35 miles an hour.
Yeah,
they can definitely run down a human, and let alone like a little kid. That'd be terrifying.
Right? I know.
The trick is, I worked at a campground with a whole bunch of geese with like all their little babies, so they were extra cantankerous. And the trick is to like just know you're bigger than the goose and just make eye contact and approach it directly. And then they eventually are like, okay, you're scary, you're bigger than me, I'll run away. But there are so many good videos on YouTube. If you do Canada goose versus, mwah, amazing.
Versus any other creatures, I would presume.
Yep. Like there's like a bunch of soldiers going into a building and one Canada goose who's like mad that they're in its little area and it scatters them. It's great.
I love it.
But we had Pam Perry, our wonderful non-game wildlife biologist, on this week to talk about migratory birds.
John, you already talked about cranes this morning, and usually you hear them before you see them.
I've been out with birders in the woods, and they'll be like, oh, that's a black-throated blue, or that's a green, or, you know, they're naming them off just on their sounds. I am not that person, but when it comes to sandhill cranes, once you've heard them, you will never forget them. They are, they're like as identifiable as a crow. They are
that rattle, and it travels for so long.
Oh,
and
my God.
So I was checking my earliest record, March 10th, ooh, which is today.
Today, yeah.
But I'm not expecting them to come in today.
Nope.
The wind is wrong. They're south of here. They're down in that Benton County, Stearns County, towards St. Cloud area. And there have been some sighted there. And once they start moving, of course, they can travel a long distance quickly. I think I said a couple of weeks ago, watch for the south winds.
Yeah.
Because that's when new stuff is going to come in. And that's when the birds are moving. And just be really aware. And oh, I was checking the weather earlier this morning, which I do all the time, and we got east, southeast winds, and there's no good south winds for a while.
So, Pam, I'm curious, when they migrate, do they migrate, you know, like the geese in big flocks, or are they more like two or three kind of coming north? You said they can go long distances. Do they? I would think.
You know, John, they do both. They do both. Because when they're leaving their winter areas, they're in big flocks.
Yeah.
I saw that in Florida. They would go up and up. They're very noisy. They go up. They're kettling. And then all of us, a whole bunch of them head north.
Yeah.
But I think as they get further north, then they are more in family groups or pairs, mostly pair, you know, that kind of like that, coming in small groups.
Yeah.
So they're going to do both. But up here, we're not going to see the big flocks, not in the spring.
So
they're working their way north. They're looking for food. And then they're going to, oh, I know where we nested last year. Let's go over, you know, and they're going to seek out that area.
Is that typical of birds in general? Do they return to their natal areas for the most part?
Well, if they've been successful, yes.
So they can...
They try to return to those areas because they found food, they raised their young, they know an area. You know, it's not a haphazard thing.
Yeah.
You know, this is something they learn, and they do return to those areas.
Now, the sandhill crane call, I think, is one of the wonderful things of spring. It's very recognizable. I think anyone who hears it once will hear it again, be able to identify it. Here's the sound. Have you heard any of those yet this spring?
Not yet this spring, no. And I'm in Brainerd.
Okay.
So around where Pam is as well. And I've been keeping my ear out, though, because that is so a sound of spring for me, for sure.
Yes. Just,
I love that sound. And like John said, it is recognizable as a crow or as a blue jay or any of the other birds that have a very distinct call. Once you know it, you know it. And you can
absolutely
hear it quite a distance away. I mean, as they are flying over you.
Yep. I'm on my second crane call of the year.
Nice.
So they're as far as I am. And have you seen the Hopkins Law map that John likes to reference about like the way that spring moves north across the state?
No, I haven't.
So if you're collecting all the data, you get to be the center of the universe. And of course, John Latimer is the one who collects all of the phenology data. So the center of the universe in this map is Grand Rapids, is zero. And then everyone else on the map is either days before Grand Rapids that you see something or days after Grand Rapids that you see something. So I'm about 10 days ahead of Grand Rapids in the spring and then presumably behind Grand Rapids in the fall. So given that I heard my first sandhill crane last week, I would expect maybe John will hear one in the next 3-4 days. And I'm not quite sure where Brainerd is on that map. Haven't heard one already? Probably soon.
Yeah, pretty close here, I would guess. We did just get some more snow. I don't know if that deters them from moving a little bit longer. We got snow here yesterday. We got snow here today. It looks like we're getting some more snow here tonight. So getting some of that spring snowfall in our neck of the woods.
That's an excellent question, whether sandhill cranes are cued by temperature or by daylight. Because great blue herons arrive in that same, like, 10-day window year after year, no matter what the weather is. And whereas, like, red-winged blackbirds vary all over the place. I wonder about sandhill cranes. I'd have to look at John's data to figure it out, but...
Well, the south wind thing is interesting to me. I've never really thought about how prevailing winds would be part of the equation. I mean, there's so much about bird migration that just seems like magic, honestly. The way that they're able to navigate and figure out exactly where to go when they return. Similar to monarch butterflies. Like, what? How are you able? I mean, I'm decent with directions, okay? But, like, to be able to travel across the entire length of the United States with no MapQuest, no Atlas.
MapQuest.
Yeah. That was an elder millennial reference. Who's using MapQuest? You know, I do know people who still like to print out their directions instead of relying on the old GPS just in case, but... Uh-huh. I'm not one of those people, but I was at one point in time.
Yep.
We've all gone through the evolution.
It's amazing that they're able to navigate all the way from Minnesota to like a couple of specific mountains in Mexico. I wonder how they do that. Whether it's stars or...
I don't know. There's got to be a lot vibes? Of different...
I don't know.
Just feeling the vibes. I mean, it is very impressive. It's one of those mysteries of nature that has always sort of wowed me.
Yeah. And, okay, so have you read the book An Immense World by Ed Yong?
No, I haven't.
It's phenomenal, and it talks a lot about those mysteries of nature, including ones that we are just now discovering. And one of the ones that I thought was just so fascinating, because it has to do with phonology, is that birds' ears change depending on the season. So... And a bird's song sounds entirely different to a bird than it does to us because of the ways that our ears are different. So we're really good at finding pitch, so distinguishing between two notes, but distinguishing tiny, tiny little variations within the note, we aren't very good at. So sound is a frequency. If a sound averages out to, say, 1,200 megahertz or something, I'm making that number up, we'll hear it as one pitch. But the bird can tell whether if it's a steady tone all the way through or if it is varying around that 1,200. And so that is what they are paying attention to, those like little micro variations in song. That's what they're paying attention to in fall. And so they lose some of their pitch in fall when they're like gathering up into flocks. Like if you think about chickadees, for instance, they're gathering up into flocks in fall. They're like kind of figuring out hierarchies. They're listening for predator sounds. And so they're really interested in those fine details of the song. Whereas in spring, when the males are singing their cheeseburger, what the females are paying attention to is whether that change in pitch is precise every time. And so their ears change to lose the ability to hear those micro variations, but be able to tell pitch like really perfectly.
So if this male is more precise in his song, he is a more attractive mate. Is that it?
Yep. Pretty much. And the only reason that they discovered this is that they were doing a study on birds' hearing and they happened by chance to have two different study sessions, one in winter and one in spring. They were not going out to discover this. It just happened to work out like that. And they found that these two groups were like within the same species, their hearing was entirely different.
I find it interesting that some of the greatest scientific discoveries happen that way, right? Where it's like we're asking a completely different question and then suddenly we get blindsided by this totally unexpected result or something that's like gumming up the works of the data. And it's like, why is this happening? Oh, because their ears completely change in one span of a year.
Right? It's wild to me. And then there are other species where the male's ears are entirely constant throughout the year, but the female's ears change. So even within a species, they're not hearing the same thing.
Well, I think that's the case with humans a lot of the time, too. Let's be real.
Okay. That's fair. I don't know if they have, you know, differences in ear anatomy to explain that, but we can hope.
Differences in anatomy in general, perhaps.
Yes. But in frequencies, maybe not.
Yes.
But yeah, this book, An Immense World, is just like chock full of stuff like that. Can't recommend it enough.
That sounds like my cup of tea.
Yep. It's great. And our ears are very similar to birds' ears, in that we hear kind of the same range of pitches. So to our ear, I think it's a whippoorwill call has kind of three notes. To the whippoorwills themselves, it has five notes because they can distinguish those small changes.
So if whippoorwills named themselves, they would have included five syllables instead of three.
Yeah.
Good to know.
And if you slow down the song, I guess you can hear all five notes. Oh, there's so many things I want to know. I want to have a bird's ears for a day so I can listen to all of that stuff.
Oh, I was just going to say, I just read a book that has been on my shelf forever. I finally got around to reading it. I'm on a mission, Charlie, to read as many books that I own that I haven't ever read before this year. And so I read a book called Prodigal Summer by Barbara Kingsolver. And Barbara Kingsolver is an author that very much includes nature and beautiful descriptions of nature in her writing. And there was a whole discussion in there about these canaries that used to exist in the Appalachian Mountains that looked like what you would imagine like a parrot would look like in North America. And we don't have a lot of birds that are that brightly colored and that, you know, interesting looking. And we do have a lot of pretty birds, of course, but to think about it as being like a multicolored parrot-like bird. And unfortunately, you know, humans did what humans do and they went extinct. But it was an interesting thought of just these parrot-like birds flying around the untouched Appalachian Mountains and how, you know, wonderful that would be. And sandhill cranes make me think of that, right? They sound ancient. Mm-hmm. They sound like they are from a different time than we are, and we're just visiting them in their world.
Absolutely. Yeah, I feel that same way about pileated woodpeckers. So our suet feeder is pretty much right outside our window, and so you get a really good look at them, and something about their eyes and their call just feels so genuinely prehistoric. And last week, Malachi and I were talking about dinosaur songs and what they might have sounded like. And the curiosity hydra struck again. I had to go dig into it. And what I learned is that the larynx, or in birds, it's called a, oh no, I know how it's spelled. I don't know how it's pronounced. Syrinx?
Okay. Maybe? That sounds right.
It's like our larynx, but different. They don't fossilize well because they're soft tissue. They're like muscle and then cartilage. But there was one that fossilized in, I forget the name of the dinosaur, but it basically looked like, you know, those desert lizards that have like all the spikes coming off of them and they're kind of flat.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that just like blown up to dinosaur size.
Okay.
But it had a birdish like larynx that happened to fossilize. And so judging from that and from like other evolutionary evidence, it's likely that dinosaurs chirped as opposed to like the T-Rex rum, and that they communicated a lot with infrasound, which is sound that's below our level of hearing, but you might be able to like feel. Like crocodiles can make a noise that makes the water ripple.
I've seen that
we before, can't really hear, but yeah, so that's an infrasound. Elephants communicate through infrasound because they can feel the trembling of the earth with their very sensitive little feetses. The thought of like a dinosaur chirping really brings me a lot of joy. And then there's another group of dinosaurs that like communicate more through infrasound. And they guess they sound like the southern cassowary, which is a bird native to Africa. And so, of course, I had to go then find the sound of one. Here it is. So it's that thump, 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 thump.
So are they making that sound with their throat?
Yeah.
Interesting, because that just made me think of when birds do in the spring, when they do the thumping on the logs, you know.
Yeah, the rough grouse.
Yeah, drumming. Grouse.
Mm-hmm. Yep, where they're like beating their... It turns out that they're not actually hitting their chest with their wings, but they're like flapping their wings forcefully enough that it like kind of creates a concussive sound wave.
Like a tiny little sonic boom that's happening around.
Like a tiny little sonic boom. Yeah, every time.
Wow. I had no idea. That's some strength that they're demonstrating there.
Right? Yeah. But like thinking about the sound of like that cassowary just blown up to dinosaur size, just echoing through like a prehistoric forest.
Yeah, right. Like that reminds me, I saw something not too long ago where they were trying to figure out what are like prehistoric humans. They're not human, not Homo sapiens.
Oh, what I call Neanderthal, which is not how you pronounce it.
Yeah, Neanderthal, right, I guess. Well, so I saw a news story not too long ago about how they were trying to figure out what they sounded like. And mm-hmm. It was like very much a lot more high pitched than you would expect. Same kind of thing where you would think of, you know, the way that they're depicted on TV and stuff. They're always sort of like doing this low pitched, almost monkey like sound. Mm-hmm. But it was surprisingly goofy. In fact, there is a story that the headline is "Listen to the surprisingly goofy voice of a Neanderthal," and that it goes way beyond the grunts. So that's what that just made me think of.
Hold on.
Are you going to find
it? To the sound of a Neanderthal. Got it. High-pitched voice theory. Interesting. High-pitched voice, BBC Science. That seems relatively reliable.
Yeah, that's what it's from, the BBC documentary, Neanderthal, The Rebirth.
The Rebirth. Okay. I'm going to hit play, and then we can just cut out the sound that actually applies.
And Patsy Rodenberg has just been given the newly created vocal tracks.
Oh, goodness, that's very interesting. This is a human. This is a human throat. This is a Neanderthal, and it's very squat. Probably the voice would be higher. So, Elliot, let's try male human voice, count over three.
One, two, three.
Just pitch up your voice.
One, two, three.
Now, we might have an idea that a macho sound is low, but that might be very useful, but it gets even more complex.
As well as his vocal tract, our Neanderthal's strange shape would also have affected his voice. His deep rib cage, a large and heavy skull, and most of all, a huge nasal cavity.
Let's just add a bit of nasal now.
One, two, three.
Now, the other thing that would be happening, which would actually increase that quality, is a very heavy skull that seems to pull down into the throat there. Now, add to that the fact that they had a fantastic chest, which is a support system of breath, which can produce enormous chest resonance and tremendous power. So I imagine that they wouldn't have subtle sounds. It would be loud, very loud, or very, very loud. And we can try and get that by... I'm now going to engage Elliot by push into me. This is actually getting him right into his body. Now speak.
One, two, three!
Now let's make a sound. Just let's make a huge R. And again.
Ah!
So the skeleton had shown that our Neanderthal wasn't just big-brained. He also might well have spoken.
What? What?
Did that voice actor win an Academy Award for that? Because he should.
Oh. Me. Also,
word. I'm sure YouTube is auto-playing something.
He got little cookie crumbs.
Yes. Oh my gosh. We just got a little bit of that cookie monster in the mix.
Scared me. A little bit of cookie monster, yep.
So that,
that
is
voice
what...
actor, amazing points.
Yes, for real. I mean, and he really got into character there. His face, his facial expressions.
That is so fascinating. Also, like, she was holding these little... I have in my hand the vocal cords.
It was very, very dramatic. Yes. You could tell that this woman is very passionate about this subject.
Okay, that was some great YouTube. Thank you. Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
I'll be putting that in the show notes for this one so people can go enjoy it themselves.
Oh my gosh, you totally should.
Okay, I can stay on track. I swear, we have another clip.
Oh, and what is the other clip?
The other clip is... Oh, right. We have two more clips. We have three more clips.
Oh,
it's
my gosh.
1:49. What am I doing? Okay. We are going to quick listen to our friends from Linwood Elementary in Wyoming, Minnesota, because they had some really interesting observations about buds.
Okay.
Greetings from the fourth grade phonology team in the Linwood School Forest. This is Haley,
Eva, and Olivia
reporting on our observations from the week ending March 5th.
This week we observed that we can tell the difference between last year's growth on our silver maple tree because the bark is much smoother and has a reddish color compared with the rougher and grayer bark of the older growth. We also observed that our Norway or red pine has bundles of two needles, which is different than the five needles on a white pine. We couldn't find a white pine around the school, but are still looking.
We also saw if we crush the needles of our white spruce, it has a strong odor. We couldn't really agree on what it smelled like, with some of us enjoying the smell and others not so much.
In the forest, we saw a lone trumpeter swan fly over silently. It was followed by three more that were trumpeting very loudly. We think the three were looking for one single swan. That is all from the Linwood School Forest. And remember,
there's no place like Linwood.
So good. Now, have you smelled like the needles from a spruce before?
Yeah, I have.
What's your opinion on the smell?
I mean, I love the smell of spruce.
Okay. Do you like cats? Have you owned cats?
I have owned cats. Yes, I like them is a day-to-day.
Okay, fair enough.
I tend to be more of a dog person, but cats are cool. Mm-hmm. I like cats.
Okay. So John Latimer has a theory going that he thinks to his nose, spruce needles smell a bit like cat urine.
Interesting.
To my nose, I think they smell great. And so for a while, I was thinking maybe this is like a genetic difference. You know how cilantro tastes good to a lot of people and then to some people tastes like soap. And it's basically a genetic thing. I was kind of wondering if it's something like that. John thinks, or John put it forward, that perhaps there is a correlation between owning a cat and having a positive association with the smell of spruce. Because to his nose, it smells like cat urine, and maybe people who own cats are more tolerant or have like good associations with that smell.
Well, see, that would be one of the reasons why I don't love cats as much is because of the smell of their urine and the whole litter box situation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I could see, I feel like the smells are similar maybe, but there's a distinction enough that I'm like, this is clearly outdoorsy, sprucey smell compared to indoorsy cat smell.
Okay, so that's interesting. So we'll just need to get some more data points to, you know, check this against John's correlation.
Well, send us a speak pipe if you have something to say about whether or not you like the smell of spruce and if you think that that is any correlation to the smell of cats.
Speak down the pipe. Speak yes. down the pipe.
Please.
Please. And the link is in the show notes. Now, John also had something to say about maple buds this week.
While I was in the cities, too, I was at staying with my daughter. Right across the alley from her house is a big silver maple. And it's big. It's a nice big tree. And I looked at it with the binoculars, and it was breaking flower bud. So it was actually in flower at this point. That's almost a month ahead. I think it's somewhere around the 6th or 7th of April that I usually look for the silver maples here to flower. And then it's another 10 days before the red maples flower. But to see them in flower down in the cities, to see this one old tree in flower down in the cities, was pretty exciting. Not to be ignored. Spring is definitely creeping its way north. I'm pretty convinced that it'll be average or a little bit early this year. We'll see. Back home here, the trembling aspen, are more and more of them are breaking bud. If you're looking at your aspen in your yard and it's starting to look like the ends of the branches are kind of getting fatter, get your binoculars out, take a close look, brace up against something. You're going to have a steady hand and look at the buds, and you will see these little gray fuzzy aments, they're called catkins. They are the beginnings of the flowers. Typically the males are the ones that flower first, and they are definitely increasing. I've had some in flower for almost a month now for the one, but several others that began to flower right around the 1st of March, and more every day. So keep an eye out for those.
So have you taken some time to look at a maple bud before, or a maple flower?
I have, because of John talking about it in previous springs. And I noticed, yep. I've been able to now tell the difference between a male and a female red maple, for instance, because of his mm-hmm. explanations of it.
Good old John, getting us all to take time to look a little bit more closely. One of the things that I've really enjoyed about that process for me is, like, so vocabulary words. There are two types of trees. They're the dioecious trees, which means they have a male tree and a female tree, and they're different trees. And then there are monoecious species, where both male and female flowers are present on the same tree. And generally speaking, maples are dioecious. There's going to be a male tree in one spot and a female tree in another spot. But in his yard, John has a silver maple that has both male and female flowers on it. Not just like a branch, which is kind of more common, is you'll like see a male tree with a female branch or so, but on the same little flower bud cluster, there are both female and male flowers on it. And I don't know, I just think that's fascinating and a little bit affirming. Like, yeah, that
is totally fascinating. I mean, you would just assume that there would be more stringent rules for plants or something, but I think that nature mm-hmm. continuously shows us time and time again that there are no rules. Always mm-hmm. there is going to be people and creatures and plants and everything that are not falling within what scientists once thought were the rules, you know?
Exactly. Yep. And I think that, you know, I think for a long time, scientists, and particularly like evolutionary scientists, were very much seeing the world as like tooth and claw, competition is key. And there's been this huge shift in discovering that cooperation is key. And also, like, maintaining variation within a species is key. And that, like, it is so much better for a species to have a lot of variation than just to be one very rigid thing. Anyways, that's what the maples make me think of.
Has John ever found out, like, how unusual that is or how common it is? I mean, maybe he just notices it more than the average person. There probably is, you know, trees that have both
I think it goes without saying that John notices more than the average person. It's been a couple of years since I looked it up, but I think it was something around like 5 to 10% of maple trees had some amount of, you know, sexual variation between just being solidly male or solidly female the whole tree through. But I will have to fact check myself on that one by next week.
I love it. Very interesting.
Last one before we go is on birdcast, which we can use to kind of see the amount of migration happening by county within Minnesota.
I wanted to mention the birdcast, the migration.
Oh, dashboard. Yes.
It's time to start checking that again. That's out of Cornell University, and where they look at the radar and then they can count how many birds are going through. And I checked it for last night, and they said the nocturnal migrant numbers were zero.
And it's snowing and the wind is from the north. Yes, I'm not going anywhere.
Everything's wrong. But if you go on there, you put in your county. So it's specific for your county, which is just so great. You can scroll down to the bottom and they'll tell you the expected nocturnal migrants. And this, and they had, I checked a couple days ago, they didn't have anything there. And now this morning they did. And what did they listed Sandhill Crane, Ross's Goose, which is a white goose that will show up sometimes with Canada goose, wood ducks, teal deer, American tree sparrows, and snow buntings. So those are the ones they're expecting to move, but they had zero last night. So, oh, well.
Yeah, if you haven't checked out Birdcast, would thoroughly recommend it. It's nice to see who else flying over your head in the middle of the night.
I just brought it up to look at it myself, and northern Minnesota's look pretty dark for the next few days, and they have the precipitation noted on the map. But still, across the country, 14 million birds expected to take flight tonight. So,
yeah. And as we get into April and May, you'll see these numbers just skyrocket. It's so cool to think of all those millions of birds flying over you.
I think I'm going to sign up for these snoozing migration alerts so I can get email alerts about birds coming in.
Yeah. And remember to turn off your outdoor lights at night so that they can all migrate a little bit more safely.
Good call, Charlie.
Thank you for joining, Chelsea. Anything you want to plug before we end?
Oh, just that I love the Season Watch pod, and I'm so glad that I finally got to be on an episode. So
at last, long, long in the works, finally yes, happened.
For sure. I really had fun today. Thanks, Charlie.
This has been another edition of the Season Watch pod. You can make it better by letting us know what you are curious about. What are you seeing? What are you hearing out there? Send us a speak pipe. Find the link in the show notes through podcasts like Apple or Spotify, or at our webpage, kexe.org-seasonwatch.